have a good shiur today, a world, oh boy. Okay, let's begin at the beginning. Today is December 15th, 2014. Hard for me to realize it's 100 years since World War I. I grew up yet in a bit of a shadow of World War I. And here we are in Yerushalayim. I'm very upset with Vic Snow. He left Israel because he was afraid of the cold. And I just found out that Vic goes to a Brit of a great nephew in Cleveland. Vic, if you're listening, how the heck did you manage Cleveland? And now I know your name is Vic Snow in America. It's Vic Rain here, and you better hurry back because the climate is living up to your name. I just want to begin, first of all, two corrections. Yesterday in Shir, I don't know what I actually said, but I was so carried away. When it comes to Yibun, let me just read the pasuk to you, because we can't be smarter than an open pasuk in the Torah. Okay, and you all know the pasuk, and then the kitetze. So I was talking about the shlichut. I was dealing with the problem of zikui get shlichut for Yibun. You have to hear the shir to understand what I was doing, Rabbi Yudalovich. So I know I corrected myself, but I know that whether the first time what I said the first or last time, but I just want to make it clear, it's the woman who takes the man's shoe off. And I have a suspicion I might have said the man takes the woman's shoe because we call them the choletz. In Hebrew, it's choletz. So I just want to correct myself. I was thinking in Hebrew at the time. So please, I don't want to change a pasuk in the Torah. Also, I want to make a very important correction. We spoke about Rabbi Yeruchim Gerelik, and I mentioned that his son died, and I mentioned the wrong name. It's Abba who died, not his eldest. Rabbi Chaim Meiser, I believe you mentioned that Rabbi Yeruchim Gerelik's son, Chaim Meiser, is deceased. Baruch Hashem, he's alive. Was a Rebbe in Philly for many years. He left a couple of years ago to start his own yeshiva. Rabbi Yeruchim's son, Reb Abba from South Fallsburg, passed away a couple of years ago. So that's a very important correction. But I want to add to it that there's a Hasidic saying that if someone says to you, they spread a rumor you're gone and you're alive, it's the Skula Farichet Yomim Tova. So I want to say to Reb Chaim Meiser, it's the Skula Farichet Yomim Tova. Okay, so that takes care. All right. Now, I just want to dedicate the shiur today, our Talmud from last year, Chaim Meiselman, just lost his grandfather, whom he was very close to, Dr. Harry Meiselman. Dr. David Meiselman, who was the brother of Reb Moshe Soloveitchik's son-in-law, Dr. Harry Meiselman. And he writes about his grandfather, that he was a student and confidant of Milton Friedman. Now, am I right? Milton Friedman was an economist. Okay, very big in the United States government, a Yiddish cup. So I dedicate to the memory of Dr. Harry Meiselman, and I say to, to Dr. David Meiselman, and I say to Chaim Meiselman that the nechama is the nachat your grandfather has to have a grandson like you. About last week's shiur, Zehafach Galim, all over the world, the fact that the Reb David Lipschitz's daughter and son-in-law were here, and among the many who contacted us, and the Waxmans were contacted by tens and tens of people who were listening. They didn't believe so many people listened to his shiur given in Gris Kolel. But a person named Dr. Moshe Nis from the United States, I gave him the title doctor. Let me just see if he tells me what he's doing here. But he's an attorney, so probably has a doctorate, a jurisprudence doctorate. My father, Dr. Edmund Nis, was a Talmud at Yeshiva, graduate of the college, 45, Smicha, 48. And he taught at Central for 22 years and never ever tolerated any criticism of yeshiva. Why? He came as a refugee in 38. He found himself at YU in 41. In January 42, my father went to see Dr. Belkinzal to announce withdrawal from yeshiva because of lack of money. With a smile, Dr. Belkin said, "Go back to class." And never again was my father asked for tuition. A sponsor had been found, and my father, despite searching, never found out who it was. This scene played out innumerable times over decades, with heaven knows how many others. So why you should have a schut, they have difficult times now, you know, what happened with Montefiore. Sad, but they should have a schut and come out of it in dignity. Then he talks about Reb David, whom his father was very close to. And I just want to quote one sentence. "If the Rav was the heart of the yeshiva, Reb David was its soul." And he goes on to describe his father's relationship and his relationship with Reb David Lipschitz. So Baruch Hashem, there's a lot to be proud of. Now, so last week we spoke about the life of Reb David. We spoke about his role in yeshiva. And again, this was a Litvisha. Dr. Belkin was like a glue. Wherever he could find a Litvisha personality, he attracted him to the yeshiva. He glued him to the yeshiva. Reb David's life, Reb David's achievements, Reb David, the soul of the yeshiva, very well said, very well said. As I described in class, his handshake was like Rabbi Levine. But I'll tell you what's sad, and here I just go one step further. Reb David came to America, they lost one daughter, and it's what Hitler did, you know, at least three children survive. One was brought over at the age of five, Shulamit, the other two. One was, as Chaya said, she was born in Chicago. Her sister was born in New York. Her mother's pregnancy was the longest pregnancy on record with her. That was Reb David's excuse to Dr. Belkin why he can't make a decision about the yeshiva. And the Rebbetzin had Rabbanit Behirayon, and he couldn't give an answer. Coming, not coming, yes, no. And Shulamit marries a beautiful shidduch, Reb Nosson Kamenetsky, the son of Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky. I produce a picture of his Sheva Brachas, their Sheva Brachas, Shulamit and Nosson, in the Rav. There's a picture taken in, it's in Rebbetzin Pesha's apartment across the street from the yeshiva. Sheva Brachas, or it was from David's apartment across the street in the Lifshitz home. And there's the Reb speaking, and there you see the young Nosson and the young Shulamit. Reb Mordechai Elephant is in the picture. It's a fascinating, fascinating picture. Little did I dream that one day I would have my granddaughter-in-law is a great niece of Reb Mordechai Elephant. So I even tie in with that. I tie in with Litvisha families today, Yekisha families, and Ungarisha families. I now tie in with Moroccan families and Libyan families as well. And we keep going. Baruch Hashem. Kibbutz Goliath. So here, Reb Nosson, a very interesting individual, Reb David's son-in-law, genius abilities. Not all of Reb Yaakov's children were on the highest level, but certainly the two greatest lamdanim among them is Reb Nosson and Reb Shmuel. Reb Shmuel, of course, is very well known. Reb Nosson came in Aliyah about the time we did, it may have been a year before. And here you have an individual raised in the Haredi world, but being the son of Reb Yaakov and the son-in-law of Reb David, he did not have the narrow-mindedness that you find in the in some parts of the Haredi world. And he worked very hard on his monumental work, making of a gadol. Originally, Art Scroll got involved. Just the inside story, just for 2 minutes. Arskol got involved with coming out with a volume on Reb Yaakov. And I believe it was Yonason Rosenblum, ultimately, who came out with it. A great deal of the research was done by Reb Nosson. But Arskol couldn't publish a volume by Reb Nosson about his father for the same reason I could have never been assigned a doctorate on Rabbi Revel if we knew 50 years ago what we know today, that Rabbi Revel and I are cousins. You understand? There's a prejudice. A family member cannot, when you do scholarship, there's a difference. You're writing a memoir, fine, write whatever you want. But when you do scholarship, scholarship has to be totally as much as a human being can be without prejudice. So Reb Nussan worked very hard because he had collected a lot of material on his father, and only part of it was published in the original biography. And by the way, that biography of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky is one of the better and more honest biographies of Artscroll, because Reb Nussan was involved in it as well. So he worked very hard, and he put together Making of a Kotel. The day that he got the first copy from the publisher, I met him minutes after he got the copy. Where did I meet him? In Machne Yehuda, in the Minyan factory for Mincha. You know, there's the Sundal Shul. The Sundal Shul probably has more Minyanim than you have in all of, I don't know, Philadelphia, Detroit, and Los Angeles put together for Mincha. Maybe in Borough Park, if you take all the shuls, maybe it equals the Sundal Shul. You know, you have five, from was it 12 o'clock on, you can have 5 minyanim going at once. For 3, 4 o'clock, you can't even walk into the place. Then there's Marib upstairs, the Sfadim, they're 3 minyanim. They daven earlier, they daven after the plug. It's an amazing, no shachris is daven there. It's a cherim against davening shachris there. When I used to walk to Machon Gold, I would daven shachris a few blocks over. There was a, but there, no, not allowed to daven shachris. Why? I don't know. Maybe they cut into all the shuls in the neighborhood, so they made a deal. Shachris were not open, but Mincha Maariv were open. Anyway, so I met Reb Nussan there, and he showed me the two volumes, and he was so happy. And then the world caved in on him. So I want to say a few words in defense of Reb Nussan and show you some documents that you will never forget. And I have them right in front of me. First of all, to be correct, let me give you details. Making of a Gadol, the first edition, the original edition, came out in 2002. A book came out afterwards, which you cannot buy, you cannot get. About 50 copies were distributed, each one with a number. I have one of the numbered copies. We had the promise. It cannot be made public. I think Reb Nussan put in a clause until 25 years after his death. The title of the book is Anatomy of a Ban. The second edition, or it's called the improved edition of Making of a Gadol, Anatomy of a Ban, B-A-N, a cherem, a ban. I'm pronouncing it right, a ban, 2003. Improved edition, Making of a Gadol, 2004. Now, I have to tell you, there are very few changes between the first edition to the improved edition. Probably the one major change is a certain story was left out. I think it was in a footnote, and it just shows you the mentality. I've said this in class many times over the last 12, 13 years, that the Rav once called me a Reformed Jew. And lo and behold, when they're working on the Rav's tapes on Sanhedrin, they found the tape where the Rav calls me a Reformed Jew, and they made me a copy of it. I played it in the kollel, and it was a riot. I said a svara, and the Rav didn't like the svara. He said, "You are a reformed rabbi," you know. It like was, and the whole class is laughing. So I told the boys that the Rav called me a Reformed rabbi. It's the greatest compliment you can get. It shows who mitzaches alecha. Right, he didn't just dismiss it, he reacted, all right, he slapped my face. But that's part of, one time he slapped my face and 10 minutes later he said, wait, maybe Arnold is right. Yeah, there is something there. So, all right, I said, but my classmates had no right to laugh. That's what upset me. But, you know, if someone, so it turns out when Rabbi Aaron Cutler was in London on one of his trips to Eretz Yisrael and he returned via London, he gave a shiur in London. And in London, some guy with a red beard, people told me they know exactly who it is, he's no longer alive, he asked the question, and Rabbi Aaron, who, when he was giving shiur, was hail, fire, and brimstone, and he jumped at the guy, Vasaitmanda, Paraduma, what are you, a Paraduma, that's the question you're asking? So it was written up in a footnote, the Shon HaRabarim couldn't admit, and it was well known. I learned in Lakewood what I used to see in Lakewood. I was flabbergasted too. I grew old and did my research on the yeshiva in Europe. I found out when the Netziv would give a shir, they'd start shouting at him and screaming at him, and he yelled back, and this was written to the Oraita, what used to go on. And Rabarim was like that in Lakewood. I remember coming in, Amoritz! And they would yell at their eye, it was unbelievable. So they wrote it up in a footnote in the first edition. The family was very upset. So he had it taken out of the improved edition. That's the only real change I know of between the two editions. Okay. Now, you talk about Rabban.
When do you think that culture changed?
What, excuse me?
When do you think that culture changed? They were like that in Lakewood with
Rabban. I don't know what goes on today. But what happened was the Americanization. When you go into a university, where did you go to school? You went to print. Where did you go? Penn. University of Penn. No, did you yell at the professor? So you understand. I once said, when I was teaching Michala, early 70s, and I was just learning what Israeli culture is about. I told you, I used to sit with my top students one day a week. Rabbi Gold, that's why I got to become very friendly with Rabbi Goldberg, because his daughter Leah and Kalman Kahana's daughter Tov, they used to sit with me. There was a Shani, what was her last name? Shani Shechter, I believe it was. Her father was very big in the Bank of Israel, and they used to sit with me one day a week and fill me as I said. Look at the Knesset here. They shout at each other. It's disrespectful. In America, Republicans and Democrats respect each other. No one will interrupt another person speaking. So the girl said to me, look at the English Parliament. You ever see the English Parliament in session? They yell, they shout, they cut you down. So you see your influence. In America, you're in Columbia University, you're in Princeton, you're in Yale, you're in Harvard, you're in Yeshiva University, Yeshiva College. No one, you're going to shout at a professor? There goes your A, there goes your B. And these professors, you know, take it seriously. They're not like a good Rebbe who enjoys being challenged. I mean, told these are amaretz, and you got to bounce back to show if you're right or wrong. And if you're wrong, you have to admit, gentlemen, I'm an amaretz. If you're right, don't gloat. But Baruch Hashem, the Rebbe can prove his case. It's a different atmosphere, but it changed, it changed. In YU, no one would dare talk that way to the Rav. There was fear of the Rav. You understand that it was not healthy. You know all the memoir literature. Chaim Potok might have been a great Torah Jew if not for his fear of Rabbi Yeruchim Yerelik or Mori Rebbe. All right. Anyway, be it as it may, I don't know if it changed entirely. I haven't been to a shiur in Lakewood, but that was Europe. I have books on top of books of memoir literature, because out of Volozhin came all the maskilim. You follow? And they wrote beautiful Hebrew, and they wrote memoir, and the fighting that went on, and whoever, the Netziv slapped the student, the yeshiva went on strike, you don't know what went on, the student was clean shaven, so yeah, you can look at my face, you know, right away, I shaved with an electric shaver, but if you shave with a razor, oh, it's fabulous. So this kid evidently, by the way, in my days in Lakewood, they shaved with depilatory. The smell was all over the yeshiva, but you got quite a shave. If you left it on more than 9 or 10 minutes, you had no face left. That's a different story. Yeah, so you had to be very careful. And they used to take it off with a toothbrush, a container, a toothbrush plastic box, container, cotton, whatever you want to call it. So the Netziv was chayshish, this Talmud shaved with a razor, he gave him a smack. Yeshiva went on strike until the Netziv apologized. And in all the memoir literature, it's written up. So, you see, yes, Shmuley.
Why was the making of a little band? It was just this one story.
No, that's what he changed. The band I haven't even reached yet. Relax yourself. What do you think this is? Like yesterday's shir, where you were the king, I needed all your knowledge about the highways in London. He was the star. He's not. You're not finished yet. And you should know that Yomo brought me a picture this morning of the highway we were talking about, the circular road. It's a small compared to Queens Boulevard's. It's a garnish. Mamish a garnish.
But it's amazing what went on over that highway. And the other one is Hempstead Gardens, which we'll talk about next week, which again, I'll bother you with questions if I have the reality as it is. Anyway, coming back here, now you talk about a Gadol. You talk about Baron Cutler. Baron Cutler was Kletz, was Lakewood, was a Litvish Gadol. And I told you more than once, when the Rav had the problem that Weingarten called him and can you take the Jews out on Yom Kippur out of Cuba, who did the Rav call? The Rav didn't call the Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Rav didn't even call Rav Moshe Feinstein. The Rav called Rav Aaron Cutler. Remember what I told you? Weingarten met him years later and he asked Rebbe, why did it take you 2 hours to get back to me? And the Rav told him, because I wanted to consult with Rav Aaron Cutler. And only when Rav Aaron told the Rav, be Mechalel Yom Kippur, did the Rav paskin lechalel Yom Kippur. So you see, you write about Rav Aaron was a giant, but you got to do justice to Rav Aaron. Rav Aaron, like Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, like the Lubavitcher Rebbe, they were the only siblings in their family to remain from. You understand what I'm saying? Rav Aaron had a sister. His sister was not from. I know people who knew the sister. Not only not from, she thought that Rav Aaron was a total failure. Vasas Gavarn with them. What became of him? A Rebela, a Kleina Rebela. I'm quoting her. I'll give you the source in a minute. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, none of his siblings remained from. It's true. From his family, grandchildren in the Midwest, very well established, they became Balei Tshuva. Baruch Hashem. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, two brothers, none were from. Not only none were from, Lubavitch probably doesn't want to talk about it, but there's Eidut Nimana, that one brother used to walk past the Lubavitcher Shul in South Tel Aviv when he knew they were getting out Shabbos after Musaf smoking a cigarette. Okay? By the way, from that brother, it's the only living relative, blood relative of the Rebbe. It's a niece who she may live in Israel today. She was, I believe, a professor in London where that brother ultimately goes and dies in London. So you see, now this is not disrespectful. When you talk about Rav Aaron Cutler, you have to show the challenges to him. You have to show the man their variant versions. Did he go to Moscow? Didn't he go to Moscow? The sister wanted him to leave Yeshiva. The version I heard in Lakewood was that he already was on the what we would call the trolley car to head to the train that would take him to Moscow to join his sister. And Rav Reuven Grzybski ran after him and pulled him off and pulled him back to Slabodka. Now, you don't have to be a great genius. This already explains psychologically why Rav Aaron was so opposed to any form of general studies, of secular studies. The Lubavitcher Rebbe had a schizophrenic approach. If you came to him, if Rafi came to him at the age of 12, what should I do now? The Rebbe would tell him, go to Lubavitch High School and then sit and learn in Tomchei Tamimim and Chas v'Chalila, don't go near college. If you came to the Rebbe, third year college or in graduate school, the Rebbe would tell you finish your degree and go on to teach and show the world one can be a great professor. He didn't have that same total negativism that Rav Aaron had. Vah Hashem Bazaar, the Gemara in Chelek, if you don't learn Torah day and night. All right, it's an interesting topic. Now, Rav Nosson Kamenetsky described the story as it really was. And I don't need Rav Nosson. I know eyewitnesses, but let me give you a source. Making of a Gadol, improved edition, I'm quoting from. By the way, in scholarship, you're always supposed to quote from the latest edition. So if people quote me, they have to quote. There are all types of rules. Silver era. And you have to put a little four on top to show you're quoting from the fourth edition. And the truth of the matter is, the Revel book, there's editions and already with Hotsa with number 2, 3, 4. And the Silver book,
a whole little change in number four. So I'm quoting now from Making of Gadol, the improved edition, Mahadura Metukenet, page 311. And here he tells the whole story, a grandson of Aaron Cutler, and he gives you all the footnotes, disclosed that the Cutler family maintains a tradition that after Rabaran with some Slabatka, he returned to Minsk at the behest of his older sister who lived there. And Rab Nosson Tzvi Finkel sent Rab Reuven Grzebski to bring him back. And he goes in, and there's a footnote here, and you have to understand, he acknowledges in the footnote that they're variant stories. What I heard in Lakewood was Rabaran was getting on the trolley car, whatever it was, the means of transportation, to go to get the train to go to Moscow to join his sister, not in Minsk, but in Moscow. She was already at the Moscow University. Reb Zerich Vahavtik, that's the famous rabbi, Dr. Zerich Vahavtik, Saba Memshelet Yisrael, Golda Meir called Zerich Vahavtik, who I knew personally, she called Zerich Vahavtik the most brilliant member of the Israeli cabinet that we ever had. He was a Gaon in Tauris, the son of Reb Yeruchim Vahavtik. There's a street named after his father. I think it's called the Vayeruchim, after a sefer is given al Litvish Talmud Chacham. He played a big role in getting the people to Shanghai and dealing with Sempo Sugihara. It's very worthwhile reading his autobiography, Saridu Palid Bimei HaShoah. There is an English translation, but I read it in Hebrew. I read it when it first came out. Rav Zerich Vahavtik says that Rav Aaron's tremendous battles against the irreligious factions in pre-war Poland were rumored at the time to have been motivated by his having been somewhat caught up in the Haskalah. Gechapt oif, he writes here in Yiddish. Caught up in the Haskalah as a youth, and therefore more aware of his dangers. And the Reb Nosson Kamenetsky says perhaps he should have wrote his having been in danger of being caught up, because he never went to the Moscow University. And Reb Reuven Grzebski told about the saintly compassion which Reb Aaron displayed toward his sister during the obstacles she had put in his spiritual path in his early years. She survived the Second World War in Paris, where she had been a professor of mathematics. Later, Reb Aaron brought her to the United States, where she served on the faculty of Columbia University. He subsequently arranged her lonesome confinement, she had never married, in an old age home, and ordered her son to Reb Shneur to pay her visits. And then he goes on to describe what I can tell you from aid, from my best friends, what I heard. And you can see it in his book, but I can tell it to you from my vantage point. When Reb Shneur got very busy in the yeshiva and he couldn't get away every week to visit Reb Aaron's older sister, Malka, and he was very respectful of his older sister. She was 10 years older, and Reb Aaron's mother died when he was very young. She literally raised him during his formative years, and he had covered gadol for her. So Reb Aaron turned to the rabbinate in Queens, essentially Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld, who was, I don't have to tell you, more than anyone else, he built up Queens. And, you know, his story is amazing, that there was a Hasidic Rebbe who came to Jamaica. Jamaica had an established Torah community, and the local rabbi was very angry, Hasagat Gavul, you're taking Balabatim away from me. And ultimately the Rebbe had to leave Jamaica. And he went to Kew Gardens Hills. All you had in Kew Gardens Hills at the time was the Young Israel. And the Young Israel, famously, was makabel him, b'seva upon him, yafat, and helped him, and sent people to him to help make a minyan. And as they say, the rest is history. So Reb Aaron thanked the Fabian Schoenfeld, could you see to it that there's some Rav who will visit my sister once a week and check up on her? And one time, and I had a dear friend, he was the photography editor of my work on the Rav, Roy Albert, Rabbi Erwin Albert. Roy,
nickname. And Fabian calls Roy and says to Roy, Roy, are you free this afternoon? And Roy was very busy with funerals. He was in a shul in a played out area, which is being resuscitated today. It's people from who want to go into Manhattan live there because the rents are cheaper and it's a few stops on the train into Manhattan. It's right near Long Island City. And Roy says, yeah, I'm free. He says, come with me. It's interesting. We'll visit Rabaron Cutler's sister. So they go to visit Rabaron Cutler's sister in this nursing home. And Roy describes to me the conversation. She's talking with them, you know, she's happy, they're calm, she's alone, she's not married, there are no children, no grandchildren, no great-grandchildren, can I her, I'm never alone. But when you never marry, you're alone. It's very sad in your old age. So she was happy, and she speaks with them, and she starts bemoaning, to use Roy's word, zibakluk, that's a Yiddish word, bemoaning. Is it right? It's a good translation, bemoaning. She says, my brother Arla had the best head in our family. He could have been at Gekensheim, the greatest mathematician. He could have been the greatest mathematician. What became of him? A kleine Rebbele, a little Rebbe. And this was when Rabban was the Gadol Hadar. And this was the sister. Rabbi Solomon Shapiro, who was the chaplain in the senior citizens where she was, used to bring her the New York Times every day. The day that Rabaron died, she didn't bring her the New York Times. And she intuitively knew. She said to him, the next day, I'm afraid my brother died. And he couldn't hide it from her. And her eulogy for him was, he missed the boat. He could have been the greatest mathematician. Now, after making of a Gotlandra, and I have to tell you, in there, I'm not going to go into any more detail because the shiur's not about Rabaron Cutler now, but I told Nussan Kamenetsky when I finished reading the making of a Gotlandra the first time, and it's a book you have to read 2-3 times to really master, because he writes that he never graduated, and Reb Nussan never graduated high school. He was missing, I think he went to Torah Vadas, he was missing gym, and he never bothered to finish. He went to Lakewood, and he learned and learned and learned. His vocabulary, he's autodidactic. His vocabulary, you have to hold the Webster's unabridged with you when you read Making of a Gadol, because his vocabulary is beyond my ability, that much I can tell you. Maybe a Baron Lichtenstein can read it without a dictionary. And he tells stories of Rabaron. I said, I don't need you to tell me these stories. I said, I know these stories from when I went and learned in Lakewood. All the stories he has. Well, the Lakewood crowd, or the part of the Lakewood crowd that's very extreme today, they dance with Satma, which is an insult to Rabaron Cutler's memory, what Satma did to him. The money they cost Hinech Hatzmai, the children who are Mechallel Shabbos today, because you have no idea, Satma, you know, in this country, as you all know, there's an election campaign on power politically results in money. This was a country where everyone thought communism was great. All the kibbutzim were thriving. Only when the Likud took over and took years, we finally found out every last leftist kibbutz was milking the country for billions of dollars. But only the religious kibbutzim, they were the only ones that were salvaged. You don't know what went on here. And then you know what went on the kibbutzim. Many are dissolved, many become moshavim, many become Jewish. Don't ask. Mapai was in power. Billions of dollars went to the Mapai and the Mapam kibbutzim. So it's very important. Election here. Satma, this election too. I understand they're offering $100 to anyone who gives them their Tudat Zehut for the 24 hours that you can vote. You understand? Well, the 20 hours that you can vote. I think it's from 7 in the morning till 10 at night, if I'm not mistaken.
You mean they should not vote?
Well, of course, $100 for you to not say, hurt, you shouldn't vote. And this element that dances with the Satma today, it's beyond Torah comprehension of a Jew whose only value in life is Torah Hashem Tamima. And I hope I fall into that category. So let me quote to you now from Rabbi Yitzchak Dershowitz. This is a cousin
to the famous lawyer. The legacy of Maran Rav Aaron Cutler, a volume that came out after Reb Nosson's volume. I'm quoting from page 62. The maskilim of that period, the Gentile, enamored, self-appointed enlightenment of the masses, would attempt to entice the most brilliant young men to leave the Beis Medrash and to become academically educated. This represented a serious danger to young Aaron Cutler, and he was therefore sent by concerned family members and others to learn in Slabodka Yeshiva. Rav Reuven Grzebsky helped him, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, to get the Slabodka. And Rav Yaakov in his chesed on Rav Reuven and Taira Vadasa tended to myself, credited Rav Reuven, with thus protecting them for the winds of the times. Even in Slabodka, however, the Rosh Yeshiva was not totally shielded for danger, for he had an older sister who was religious. And this lie is repeated in the book in Hebrew that came out. You'll find it in the first few pages. Who was religious? That's an insult to Reb Aaron. That's playing down the whole struggle he had. And it's a total, absolute lie. There are hundreds of people who yet knew the sister, who are yet alive. But Achai can be Machishet Achai. How do you publish a lie like this? This is intellectual dishonesty. I'm a Talmud of the Rav. I always had the feeling that you can eat in Yom Kippur and drink. It's not as bad a sin as intellectual dishonesty. A sin. Yetzer Hara got the best of you. Intellectually dishonest, the whole personality is fardubin, is ruined, is beyond repair. Intellectually dishonest, but secular education oriented, who would write to him in Slabodka itself to try to induce him to forsake the yeshiva for the glories of the outside world. And you know that he gives the details a little bit here, and Reb Nosson goes into much greater detail, but this is the famous story that every educator should be exposed to. The Mashgiach, Reb, the Alt of Slabodka, the great Reb Eliezer Yehuda, the great Reb Nosson Zvi, his father of Eliezer Yehuda, the great Reb Nosson Zvi Finkel, did not allow his Talmud Reb Aaron to see the letters. He confiscated them. It's an interesting question. Does a Machanech have a right to confiscate letters? Think about it. What are the results when you confiscate? When Reb Aaron found out, he got very angry. And that's what I heard in Lakewood. That's when he decided to join his sister. And it was Reb Reuven Grzebsky who pleaded with him, just because the Alta made a mistake, perhaps, don't let it destroy your commitment of Torah. Stay in the yeshiva. And he then tells the story how Reb Aaron wanted to leave, stays in the yeshiva, doesn't tell it with all the details, obviously. She wrote him again and emphatically warned him, if you stay in the yeshiva, don't get a secular education and make something of yourself, then in 50 years from now, no one will ever know that an Aaron Cutler ever existed in the world. And he has a footnote. Other sources have it that this warning was not given by his sister, by one of the maskilim in Minsk. And it's a fascinating document, frightening. The legacy of Maran Reb Aaron Cutler versus Reb Nosson Kamenetsky. I come down on the side of Reb Nosson because there's nothing he wrote that I didn't know before he wrote it. I learned in Lakewood. And these stories were alive, were part of the Lakewood scene. What happened with the Torah world afterwards from Reb Nosson is a very sad story. I'm going to show you something that you will not forget the rest of your lives now, if you have intellectual honesty. Am I allowed to show it? It's a day or two before Hanukkah. It's not Chodesh Nisan. You follow me, Alex? So I'm allowed. tremendous storm broke out, and they went to Rav Yashiv. And Rav Yashiv, in that world, is recognized, was recognized, the Gadol Hador, the Posek Achron. I knew Rav Yashiv too on a somewhat personal level. It's a sad story that he was once very much in the world of Mizrahi, the world which I find myself, and he couldn't handle Rav Gorin. Rav Gorin's election as chief rabbi made him take early retirement and cut his connections with Mizrahi, with Heichal Shlomo, with the Batei Dinim, etc., etc. And later he makes a man named Metzke chief rabbi. I do not wish to comment further because I love Torah with all my heart. Now, you talk about what they call the buch. When they call it a buch, that itself is a slap in the face. If someone will say, Rakefet wrote a buch about the Rav, Shrimna buch afim Rav, that's like saying Rakefet wrote tipshut, shtuyot, about the Rav. In, if you want to say the truth, I hope you would say Rakefet katav seifa, not a buch. But they referred to Rav Nosson's work as a buch, bet vav chaf. Now you have a real problem. Tell me, who can judge if the book is kasher or not? Those of you raised in a Catholic neighborhood know that at one time the Catholics had an index to what books you could read. Understand, today, Baruch Hashem, the index is gone, but we have in our world too, if you go to Beis Yaakov, you go in and get a textbook, pages are ripped out. I've seen books where lines are blackened out. See, if I were a student, the first thing I would do would be to go to the public library, get the same book and check the lines that are knocked out. I remember my son-in-law, I'd get videos for the grandchildren, he would go through it first, knock this out, knock that out. I can't live that way. You have to b'chata b'chayim. This is life. This is real. This is what we have. You have free choice. I hope I've given you a good education and a good example that you choose properly. So there happened to have been at that time one giant of Torah recognized by all who knew English basically almost as a native language. And that was, of course, Reb Zelig Epstein, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. I taught his granddaughter in Midreshet Moria, Reb Zelig Epstein, the grandson of Reb Shimon Shkup, who was saved from Hitler, went via Japan, I believed. He never went to Shanghai. He got into Canada, was very close to Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky in those years in Canada. In those years in Toronto, Reb Yaakov taught a weekly shir in the Mizrahi. It was a different world. And Reb Zelig Epstein went to university. He had both a bachelor's and a master's. His English became like his Yiddish. It's like I live in it. Someone wrote to me, gave me Musa, that it hurts his ears to hear me say Chatam Sofa. I should say Chatam Sofa. So I wrote back to him, I'm living in Israel 46 years. This is the way we speak Hebrew here. Believe me, when I first came to Israel, Herzog in the Michalam, my students, I said the Ravid, they got Rabad. Today I say Rabad, what can I do? 46 years, this is the way we speak Hebrew here. Baruch Hashem, language is determined by usage, not by black and white rules. So, and there are big articles on it, because they're sort of losing the future in Hebrew and feminine till madna, till medu. I read a whole article that the masculine form is becoming only universal, and part of it they blame on the Anglos who came to Israel, and because in English you don't have feminine and masculine, so we eased it up and we all say hang till medu instead of hang till madna, etc. So his English became like Yiddish. And people told me, he read the New York Times daily, he was totally at home in English, he spoke English without, they say practically without an accent, and he had a bachelor's and a master's. There was a teacher at YU, also part of the Shanghai crowd, Peretz on Altamira. He went into university, became a taught physics at YU. His English was excellent, perfect. He had a bachelor's, a master's. Rabbi Belkin brought him in, not to teach Limudei Kodesh, but to teach physics.
So they gave the books to Rav Zelig Epstein to look at. And my dear students, I wish they were in silk. Here you see a letter on the stationery, Yeshivat Sharei HaTorah Gratna. Rab Aaron, it says, Aaron Zelig Halevi Epstein Rosh Yeshiva, a nenekul from Rab Shimon Shkop. In his handwriting, this is very important, because when I did research then on Zikuy HaGet, I wanted to get a letter in the handwriting of Rav Shlomo, of Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach's son-in-law, Rav Nechemya Zalman Goldberg. I wanted to see, does he disagree? Is Rabbi Krauss says he supports him. Everyone says he disagrees. I want to see it in his handwriting. I have it now. I have it in his handwriting. Here from Ben of a Gadol, from the book that you can't put your hands on yet, here is the typescript. And this letter is very simple. Kvod Hagon HaDiyasah HaTorah V'chulu Malatu Kvod HaRab Reb Yosef Shalom El Yashiv Shlita Shalom Avracha U'Bichat Kol Tov Acharei Drish Shalom Kvod Tifato B'Hokara K'Ya'ut. It's Rabbinic Hebrew. And then he says, I was asked to look at this book and to state my opinion whether this book is kasher. And he says, I want you to know that I know Reb Nissim Kamenetsky from the time he was a youngster. And he's a wonderful individual and a great Talmud Chacham, Talmud Chacham Mufak V'Yereish Shemayim Shalem. And although I don't like to get involved in communal discussions, but here I feel it's because Nefesh, what they're doing to him, the Hashmatzot, with the Fat Halbon Panim, Barabim, L'mishpacha Yekara B'Yisrael, L'chein Ani Roe Chova L'nafshi L'chavot Dati B'inyan Hazeh. And he says, I read the two books. He said, he's quoting Rakefet. There's nothing that I didn't know. He says, all these stories were well known in the yeshiva world. You understand? Not only in Lakewood, I heard them in Lakewood. They were well known. There's nothing there. He says, I went through the stories backwards and forwards. He says, like any story being told, the game telephone, there were varying versions to the story. But the Vidaiti, she'ein shum hatztaka le'ersor ha'sefa hanal. V'ani tvili, tvilati, she'ashem yitbarak yorekat amol ba'shalom. V'lo nosif l'da'ava od b'yedidut u'bahokara rabah. And his signature, Aaron Zelig Halevi Epstein. There's the signature. Yeah, there, it's underlined. He underlined it. Take a look. You see the underline. L'chein daiti en shum hatztak shen shum hatztaka le'asar ha'sefer hanal. And he underlined it.
So what did they respond?
Gentlemen, this letter never reached the hands of Rav Eliashiv. When you can write and publish that his sister was from, you're intellectually dishonest. If you're intellectually dishonest, you can do anything. And this letter was censored, thrown away, withheld, like the Mashgiach, the Saba, did to Rav Aaron, they did to Rav Eliashiv. And they put the cherem on, the book was burned in public, the New York Times picked it up. They had a full page picture. I'll never forget. It's like from the top to the bottom, two columns of Reb Nissim coming home from shul in Matastuf. He lived in Matastuf. And I asked him, how'd they get that picture? He said, he doesn't know. He was told someone was standing a block away with one of the high-powered mechanisms that Yomo would know how to use. And they're Israeli
reporter knew where he goes to shul. You don't need the KGB to tell you. And they took the picture, and there it is in the New York Times. So
why didn't they publish that letter? Why didn't they?
Reb Nissen published it. No, what do you want?
Wait, yeah, I thought only you said in the book that it was.
Oh, I see. So I will answer you. I will answer you very simply and honestly, and refer back to something you heard in class last week. At the 10th anniversary of Reb David Lifshitz's yard site, the family asked me to speak. It was at the OU. There was a very big crowd. It was a powerful talk, Baruch Hashem. But when you speak, when you know how to handle an audience, I learned I'm a Talmud of the Rav. The Rav's son, my classmate, Dr. Drach, when he signed the contract to become dean of Bernard Revel Graduate School, there was one clause in there which no one could understand. He insisted they put it in, that he not be required to give public lectures. So people asked me, I said, don't you understand? He's worried people think he has his father's ability. He has much of his father's ability in many areas, but that ability he didn't have. But if you learned how to speak watching the Rav, you interact with an audience. So in the middle of my talk, I'm staring at Reb Nissen. Many people have never forgotten it. I meet them 10 years later. They remind me of what happened. And I'm staring at Reb Nissen, and I couldn't keep the Yetzer Hara away. And I say to her, Reb Nissen, let's be truthful. You and I think very similarly, but there's one difference between us. And that difference is the cause of all your problems. And about 300 endless rabbis there, Talmud and Reb David, Rabbi. I say, I think white and live white. You think white and live black. That's your problem. Now, the reason he didn't circulate the letter, and Rakefet predicts the making of a ban will never be published, because he doesn't want to harm his grandchildren's shidduchim. Got it? Plain and simple. And I know what I'm saying. Got me? Alex, Molde, that the Rebbe's right?
It bothers you. Like I always say, when the Sephardim try to pretend to be Ashkenaz to get into a quote-unquote good yeshiva, I say, it's not a good yeshiva if they're racist.
So you're talking like Rakefet. But the world out there, they just shut down two Batei Yaakov. They won't let a Sephardiot in. What happened with the Slanim? I have to bite my tongue from telling them, you're a Slanim Chassid, you're an Apikoris to the 100th power. To build a wall that the Hasidic Meidlach shouldn't see the Svadish girls? Where are we at? What has happened to Torah? And in New York now, and when some Hasid, depends which American attitudes. You're talking Chabad and YU. In New York, they put out, you read about Yehuda and Tamar? How do you let kids read that? The Chumash last week? No? The prostitute, Aleim HaDerech? They censored it out of a Chumash in New York, that the kids shouldn't see it. Ribbono Shel Olam. The greatest gift I got from learning in YU was that I learned about sex from Masechet Gittin, Masechet Kedushin, Masechet Ketuvot, the greatest gift. Thank God there's sanctity in sex. And yeah, without sex, I always quote the Gemara, the chickens wouldn't lay eggs. Who wants to get married? I'm very upset that people who I love, who are so committed, pleaded with me before they left Israel. They have children here, children there, so they're in the States for most of the year. They pleaded with me to try to make a shidduch for a lady, 30s. I know so many young men, late 30s, early 40s. I live in part of the Bitzah, they call it, of Katamon. You understand? The shul I daven in Chabad now has a minyan, 10:30 in the morning. They should be whipped. 10, the Rebbe daven 9:30, all right? So the Rebbe, 10, oh, God. what the Hasidim did to us. So they have, I know guys run there, then there's Noah Laren, they have a 10-30 million for the singles. I talk with people in their late 30s. I make a fool out of myself. They're not interested in getting married. Any girl you mention to them, oh, I know her. Oh, this is not, so you know her. So you took her out 20 years ago. Take her out again. Maybe you missed the boat. I remember Jacob Breuer, when he finally married in the 60s, his widowed second or third cousin, he said to people it was the greatest mistake of his life that he never married. What a joy. But he served his father, you understand? He took care of the yeshiva, the day school, he was his father's right hand, devoted totally. But you talk about the greatest education. I learned Gittin, I was 14 years old. Wow, Kedushin afterwards. Okay, so you're talking about that world, that consensus. And Shabbos, when I'm following the Pasha, I said, wow, this is really Hollywood style here. Okay, and the kids, and you're building Fender. God, I can't even talk. It hurts so much, you have no idea. Okay, but I control myself. Ashlana Mechassar, someone's unconcerned. And you know how much money they made from London, from Antwerp, from Williamsburg, from Square Town, from here, from there. The money left poured in, and they went to jail. Do you remember what happened? They went to jail. They're defying a court order. Those people made more money by going to jail than they would ever make by working. Everyone got a few thousand dollars from the Rebbe when they went to jail. It's beyond words. Forget it. Don't aggravate me. I want to be able to kindle the Hanukkah lights in joy. My dear students, Reb David Lipschitz, Reb Nissen Kamenetsky, that whole family, part of the yeshiva scene. His middle daughter married into the yeshiva. You met Professor Waxman. He's a graduate, a musmach of the yeshiva. You also heard Chaya say she was happy when he chose not to go into the rabbinate and to become a professor of sociology. The youngest daughter retreated back into a calm part of the yeshiva world, and she married the son of Reb Chaim Stein, who was the last well-known Torah personality in the original Tells in Wycliffe, Ohio, if I'm pronouncing it right. I'm so mixed up already. Wycliffe, Wycliffe. I think it's Wycliffe, I was, according to the people in Cleveland. But you see what's amazing about Dr. Belkin? He was glue. He sought out every literature personality. Rav Shach, Reb Moshe Feinstein. Reb Moshe was not easy to say no. Rav Shach Mailer took it, you know, right, an invitation to dance on the moon. But he was respectful. He knew who Professor Weiss was. And you got to remember, Professor Weiss and Professor Albach, the two brothers-in-law, had tremendous respect in the yeshiva shevelt because they were goyim. They knew all of Shas on their fingertips. To a certain degree, even Professor Lieberman. But the problem with Professor Lieberman was he was in the seminary. Albeck and Weiss were in Orthodox institutions. Professor Weiss and Bernard Revel and Professor Albeck at Bar Ilan. Lieberman was in the seminary, so that presented a problem. Not to the Rebbe. The Rebbe's attitude was, keep on doing good there, you understand. But it presented a problem, which goes on until today. That's why we spoke about last week, my Talmud, Rabbi Golinkin, David Golinkin, is describing himself. It's Mamish Lieberman was 100% from. I lecture, I can't go into it now. The reason he was at the seminary, all right, this is maybe a criticism, may not be, but that's a different story. But Dr. Belkin attracted. There's one more great personality he attracted, who had a great impact on two of us sitting in this room, Rabbi Rubin and yours truly. That was Rav Lessen. But I'll talk about Rav Lessen after I finish Rabbi Belkin. I just want to come back to Rabbi Belkin and pick up where we left off with Gris Kollel. And the 70s were very difficult for Reb Shmuel Belkin. It was a very tragic period of his life. His health was failing, and the financial situation of the yeshiva was desperate. I hope we're not going to go through a similar period today. What happened at the yeshiva, with all its expansion and all that was going on, they just couldn't raise enough money. What they talk about today, the budget deficit, Einstein being two-thirds of the deficit going into heavy tens of millions of dollars on a yearly basis. And if you're well, if you're healthy, maybe you can cope with it. Dr. Belkin already, the burden, the sickness, his personal life, he was what you say in rabbinic Hebrew, a sheba kli. His second wife, Abby, was wonderful for him because she stabilized him. The Gemara says in Sota, the first Amid, Zivik Sheni is magic. Bat kol yotze, ben ploni, lebat ploni, Zivik Sheni is lefi masav. Zivik Sheni already, you get a mate who knows who you are, what you've done with your life, and you're going to get a mate who can deal with it, who can cope with it, who can handle it, who can enhance it. Zivik Sheni lefi masav. If you heard Rabbi Kazin at his 80th, I spoke about it yesterday, the 80th birthday party that I was at. You're too young because you just got to the neighborhood, but all everyone from the neighborhood was there because he's there, you know, 30 years now. So he spoke about how his wife and how they get, and he always, when he wants to put it down, he says, oh, and this is wife number one, you know, implying who knows what comes afterwards. So everyone had a good laugh. So I say a person is zaycha when wife number one turns into wife number two. That's a special schut. Because, we, you know, when you're a young kid, you're a young kid, you're getting married. My in-laws were a disgrace that such a nobody came into their beautiful family. So Baruch Hashem, husband number one turned into husband number two, and wife number one turned into wife number two. So his second wife was a real stabilizing force in his life. And here I want to tell you something. And it's a member of Dr. Belkin's family. He doesn't want me to mention his name. But you all know that right after Dr. Belkin died, the yeshiva faced total bankruptcy. And the bank, the Bowery Bank, who held the mortgage, were going to call it in, and it would have meant that's the end of the yeshiva. The whole property would have been taken over by the bank. What they would do with it, I don't know, but that's a different story. But at least they would sell it off and get back their mortgage investment. Abby Belkin, who had been a newspaper reporter and had made many contacts before, knew Governor Carey. She called Governor Carey and told him, Yeshiva University is more than just an institution. It's the finest institution that Jewry possesses in all of the United States. You cannot let it fall close. As a result of her call, Governor Carey called the president of Bowery Bank, and he agreed to delay the foreclosure. That's when Sheldon Sokol got involved. He later becomes the vice president for finances under Dr. Belkin. And everyone used to maledict Sheldon Sokol. We were classmates together in Rabbi Bornstein's Shir, as I recall. And he was a year ahead of me in college. And everyone used to, you know, he was tight, true. Here, the joke used to be that Gris Kolo can't order a toilet tissue without the approval from New York. But that, now you can understand why Rabbi Lamb was so in debt to Shelton Sokol, because he took over the financial responsibilities, and it enabled Rabbi Lamb to a certain degree to free himself from that burden, to a certain degree. And he ran a tight operation. And from that point on, Yeshiva never was near bankruptcy again. The story of how they came out of bankruptcy, once they had this extension of time, they called a meeting. Rabbi Lamb already was president. They called in some of the wealthiest balabatim who supported the yeshiva, and they hid the Rav in another room, and they made this plea, and then the Rav came into the room to be the cleanup hitter, as we say in baseball. And that evening, enough money was raised to satisfy Bowery Bank, and the rest, of course, is history. Now, there's another point that I want to make about Dr. Belkin, which in itself is interesting. And this, too, I know from my own experience. I also know from family members. He had a small family. Had a son and a daughter. As you know, the son was educationally challenged. I've never been able to establish some, perhaps someone doing the research will be able to get to it. I was never able to establish whether it was a congenital deficiency or it was a result of a car accident. I don't know. But all the living members of Dr. Belkin's family are Shomrei Torah and Mitzvot, 100%. I can read to you, I know the people. His grandson lives in Yerushalayim today. All the children live here. The grandchildren live here. Well integrated on the Israeli scene. One grandson fought in an elite combat unit in the IDF. Another son, and this I believe is a great-grandson, is a paramedic in the army, what we call a Chovesh Kravi, and the entire family, without exception. There's a part of the family I know, Mamish Shomrei Torah Mitzvot, 100%. And that's a credit to Rav Shmuel Belkin. Today, you know, we raise our children, it's a lot easier. You got to remember, he came to America penniless, 1928, barely speaking a word of English. He was in the public limelight. There was a divorce there. By the way, there's been a bit of divorce in the family. That is true. The second generation, the third generation. I asked someone from the family who has a beautiful marriage and beautiful children, I said, how did you avoid the stigma, your brother's divorced, your mother's divorced, your grandfather divorced? And her words ring in my mouth. She said, Rebbe, you asked a very good question. I knew it would be a problem, and I worked very hard to work this marriage out as beautiful as it is today. And that's a beautiful answer, and it's a great credit to Rav Shmuel Belkin. And I finally want to endorse Rav Shmuel Belkin the hesed that the Rav gave for him. And I want to thank Yitz. I made a copy for you to pick up the class. I want to thank Yitz. He reminded me about this hesed, remember? And I located it. I located it. And it's not only the hesed, but through the hesed, I solved another problem. I'll tell you in 1 second. Let me just wet my vocal cords. The commentator came out with a special edition in memory of our beloved teacher and leader, Rav Shmuel Belkin. It's dated May 5th, 1976. And the Rav's eulogy, of course, is the main part of the issue. But what's interesting there, Rabbi Rum was interviewed. They published an article about Rabbi Rum, who was, if you recall, Rav Shmuel Belkin's childhood chavruta. So they published this interview with him. Now, you remember, some biographies of Dr. Belkin said he learned in Mir. And I asked the question, what do you mean he learned in Mir? He never, as far as I know, he never learned in Mir. We know he learned from Rotten. Before Rotten, he learned with Reb Shimon, with Reb Shimon Shkup. But to say he learned in Mir, never. What are they talking about? So here in the article, Rabbi Rum says he and Dr. Belkin learned together. Afterwards, Dr. Belkin left to learn at Rotten under the Chafetz Chaim. I didn't go with him. I went to Mir, but we corresponded on Divrei Torah quite regularly. We were reunited briefly in Mir in 1928-29 when Dr. Belkin was on his way to America. So that's the puts the puzzle together. Not that he learned in Mir. He visited Mir on his way, leaving Poland, probably went from Poland to Germany. Germany, he took a boat to the United States, I would imagine. But he visited his childhood chavruta, who was learning in Mir. And maybe he spent a few days in Mir. In those days, he didn't just walk in and walk out. It's not like the airplane. Yes, Yomo?
The way he writes it, it's 28, 29. It sounds like a long time.
Well, he writes 29. I think it was 28. I'm just saying that I just added that. So he says 29, but I didn't want to get involved. Someone asking me, but he came to America, it seems, in 28. It's because he came at the age of 17. He was born 1911, but it's between 28 and 29. Who can equal the Rav? There are two books, the Open Book and the Sefer HaChatum. The two books are concerned with two different questions. The Sefer Galui, the public book, the open book, asks a very simple question. What did this particular individual do? What did he accomplish for society? What are his accomplishments? The private book, the Sefer HaChatum, asks a different question. It doesn't ask what the man did for society. Who asks? Who was he? Not his accomplishments, but who was the individual himself? The private book of Dr. Belkin remains the Sefer HaChatum, a sealed, mysterious book. The first question of the private book is, who was he? Not what he did he accomplish. Who was he? I don't know. I would like to use a certain verse from Sefer Devarim, in order to portray Dr. Belkin. It is a verse consisting of five words, but I believe these five words tell the story of Dr. Belkin. We have just read these words in the Haggadah. Arami Oved Avi Vayered Mitzrayma. I will interpret it in accordance with the Ibn Ezra. A straying, wandering, restless Armenian was my father, and he went down to Egypt. Let me paraphrase this pasuk. A restless Lithuanian yeshiva Talmud student who was my friend, Dr. Belkin. He also dreamt. He also became a visionary. Whenever I entered his room unannounced, I didn't do it frequently. I used to find him dreaming. I simply saw the dream in his eyes. His gaze used to fix on something far. It was something unknown to me, at least. Now, the question is, what did he dream about? He was an Arami Oved, a restless Lithuanian. What did he dream about? He dreamt of a generation of young American Jews who combined the good components of both an excellent secular and Torah
education. Let me tell you, Dr. Belkin's standards of Lumdis, of halakhic scholarship, are very high. I repeat, he dreamt of a generation of young American Jews who would combine both an excellent Torah education with the capability of participating in the scientifically oriented and technologically minded complex American society. However, Dr. Belkin, the restless spirit, the Arami Oveid, the restless nomad, had another dream, and this second dream was bolder, more daring than the first dream. This was his original dream. No one shared his opinion, not even people who were very, very close to him. He wanted to show the Jewish, as well as the non-Jewish community, that the Orthodox Jew is as capable of establishing scientific educational institutions as the non-Jew or the secular Jew is. He told me once, remember I looked for the source, I thought I had it earlier, here it is. He told me once, when he presented the plan of a medical school under the auspices of the yeshiva, to an internationally known Jewish abdominal surgeon, that the lady became so indignant that he said the whole project is not only impractical, but arrogant as well. And perhaps he was right. The surgeon was right. It was arrogant. But let me tell you, the restless yeshiva student of Lithuania was indeed tough, tough, and arrogant. However, his arrogance was translated into reality, and there isn't a Jew, an arrogant person, defying, and isn't a Jew, an arrogant person, defying for thousands of years the whole world? And isn't little Israel, an arrogant nation, defying the United Nations of the world? And let me give you a second answer, who he was. The American dreamer, the restless yeshiva boy, the Arami Oveid, was a great teacher, a great Rosh Yeshiva. I spent my life in teaching. I know teachers. He was a magnificent teacher. He was perhaps the teacher par excellence. His disciples were the best trained in the yeshiva. He always moved in a straight line. He knew neither of angles, nor of curves, nor of corners. His thinking was two-dimensional. His code, so to say, his coat of arms, his lumdis, the symbol of his lumdis, was the geometric plane. He did not engage in so-called analysis of depth. He had no trust in the thin abstractions of three-dimensional thinking. But whatever he said, it was logical. It was plain. It was understandable. He is responsible for the fact, only he, that Yeshiva Yisrael Chan now, as of today, is a great center of Torah. And as far as the attainment of lumdis, good real genius scholarship is concerned, it is the best place in the United States. You don't have to believe me. Just take a look at the young Rosh Yeshiva who sit right over there to my right. They were trained here. They are the finest Rosh Yeshiva of any institution, here or in Israel. Any institution. Now, at present, or 100 years ago. What do you say, Rafi? A little exaggeration? But a Rebbe boasts about his Talmidim. But I don't know. Shmuley, I don't know. You learned in YU.
Who was sitting there?
The Rashi, who was the Rabbi Shechta? Perhaps Rabbi Willick already. You have to know who the Rosh Yeshiva were in 78. I don't know. I asked you a question. Did you learn in Voloshin in the 1800s like I did? Why didn't you? Where did you get better Rosh Yeshiva? It's an interesting question. I don't know. I don't know. This classroom, am I as good as Reb Chenik Fishman, Reb Yeruchim Gurelik, Reb Noach Bornstein?
Just poetic license.
It's an interesting question.
Think. What do you say?
He exaggerated.
He exaggerated. All right. He's a Rebbe. He's a Rebbe. No, it's a Rebbe. He's a Rebbe. It's okay. And then he goes further. He was a restless dreamer who had an excellent teacher, who was an excellent teacher, was in love with the Torah. He had a romance with Torah. Dr. Belkin, and here he hits the nail on the head. See, because there's a tremendous question. How did this man succeed? When he spoke, the marbles in his mouth. It was so hard to understand him. I told you, I'm listening now. I have a tape of him, a CD, why don't they call it a CD, a Talmud made for me. And it's 1967. And he's speaking to YU rabbinic alumni. And he's giving a shiur. And he speaks in English. And then he gives the shiur in Yiddish. It's impossible. You gotta lean forward. I can understand a little bit. If you're hearing him for the first time, you won't understand one word. Not the English and not the Yiddish. How did he succeed? Dr. Belkin was a charming person. He radiated. I'll use the biblical expression for it. Chen. Chen is charm. The restless teacher. The lover of Torah. Like Yosef of old. Again, attracted people. He was indeed charming. He enchanted them with his magnetic personality, even those who disagreed with him. And quite often I disagreed with him. Even those who disagreed with him succumbed to his powerful charm. The charismatic Dr. Belkin possessed was precipitated by two basic virtues. Virtue number one, let me use the biblical expression, he was a Baal Chesed, a man of loving kindness. He was a kind person. And this you've seen from all my lectures about him. What we just said today, when he tells that kid, go back to class and never worry about money again. Bringing in the mirror, building a kollel for the greenhorns until they can acclimate to America. Bringing in B'nai Torah. He was a man of love. He was a kind person. And let me say, his kindness was not due to character weakness. See, the Rav here is very, very, his insight. Look, sometimes people are kind because they are weak or character softness. Sometimes people are kind because they are soft. All right? Dr. Belkin was not a weak person. He was tough, I said before, and firm. He was a man who exercised power, and he liked power. He practiced what the Gemara says, Gemilat Chasadim, B'mamano U'begufo. Kindness as far as money is concerned, and kindness as far as physical efforts are concerned. If there was a person who was not appreciated by his own friends, this was Dr. Belkin. He was the most unappreciated, restless dreamer, an excellent teacher, and a kind person. I will tell you something. He was, and this will come as a surprise to many of you in the hall. Remember, he's talking to the students of the 60s and 70s who barely knew Dr. Belkin. He possessed saintliness. I don't say holiness, I say saintliness. Kindness alone does not generate or precipitate charismatic chen unless it is tightly knit with saintliness. And Dr. Belkin was a saintly person. And then he goes on, the Rav, he gives four different reasons how you can tell he was saintly. And the first reason, boy, is this important in the contemporary world, a sone betza. He hated gain. He hated profit. He hated money. He didn't let it influence him. And Dr. Belkin, while he knew the importance of money as far as the institution was concerned, he had no concept of and no desire for money. He died a poor man. He died a poor man because he was a saintly man. He was a saintly man because he was a great man. And he died a great man. He simply was Sone Betza, a man who raised so much money, who was a wizard as a fund solicitor, and yet he died a poor man. And you understand? The Lubavitcher Rebbe. what was his total estate worth with the house and everything else? I think, if I recall correctly, $57,000. There isn't a Jew in Israel who isn't worth a lot more. If you own an apartment in Jerusalem, in Tel Aviv, in Haifa, or in Eilat for that matter today, you're worth more than the Lubavitcher Rebbe was worth. So the Sone Bets are so important. How many of our brethren are sitting in jail in the United States in federal prison? Lo aleinu, money, money, money. In Israel, there's a different problem. They don't go to jail. They're not tzaddikim. They're not proud people. The minute they stand trial, everyone puts a kippah on his head. It's unbelievable. Articles have been written. You see murderers, big kippah on their heads. You don't miss a mincha. You see every type of money crime. Suddenly they're before the judge, big kippah. And I've seen articles written, does it affect the judge's decision when you're wearing a kippah? Dr. Belkin was a saintly person for another reason. He lived a simple life. It's hard to find people nowadays who are satisfied with a simple life, plain simple life. Dr. Belkin lived a simple life because he was a simple man, a great man, but a simple man. There was a streak of asceticism, a streak of Porish Menachayim. He lived not to enjoy life because he hardly enjoyed it, but to create, to serve, to sacrifice. And he died on the altar of Torah. He had saintliness. He could live a life stripped of all manners of frills and petty, petty enjoyments. He hated the formalities. I know that some people misinterpreted, misunderstood it. He hated the formalities of protocol and the public etiquette. Even from time to time, he had to go through it, but he never enjoyed it. And that's the famous story with that Vic Geller tells about Rabbi Joseph H. Lookstein sending Dr. Belkin a long letter after he was president for a year or two, trying to help him and correct him how to appear in public, how to speak, how to dress. But that was not Dr. Belkin. That was Rabbi Joseph Lookstein. Rabbi Belkin was a saintly man for a third person, a third reason. He had, what shall I say, I used the Hebrew term, a lashon nekiya, a dignified speech. Judaism has always emphasized the significance of the word. The latter, if uttered with dignity and sanctity, may create a world. The letter, the word uttered with the vulgarity, may destroy a world. Dr. Belkin's speech was clean and dignified. I never heard him malign anybody, or make some derogatory remarks about people. Enemies who indeed wanted to destroy him, indeed wanted to destroy him physically and spiritually, he never said a bad word about them. He was also a saintly person in his relationship to Yisrael. Dr. Belkin knew how to accept suffering. He suffered with dignity. Dr. Belkin knew, as I said, to suffer, how to meet crises and how to confront disaster. He never complained. For all the years that I knew Dr. Belkin, I never heard a single complaint from him. He never asked any questions. He never engaged in self-righteous monologues. Vayidom Aaron. And Aaron said nothing. A great man, a saintly man, says nothing. He was silent. A Dr. Belkin, a saintly man, must possess the heroic quality of being mute at a time when one is ready to talk. And finally, he ends off, we prayed for a miracle. Apparently, we were unworthy of a miracle. It happened. We ask just, we bid you farewell. Leich l'shalom, v'stanuach, v'keitz hayamim, k'chol chai. We promise thee that yeshiva will be guarded by us and it will continue to be a great center of Torah. Your name will never be forgotten. Next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, I'll end off these lectures on Dr. Belkin with reminiscence of my encounters with Dr. Belkin and how I was privileged when all was said and done, at a time when most students barely knew him, I was able to come to him and to know him and understand him a little better than most. So what did we do today? We finished out Reb David Lifshitz. We spoke about his son-in-law. Next week, we'll speak about Reb Yaakov. Next time we meet, we'll speak about Reb Yaakov Moshe Cohen Lesson and his son-in-law, Rav Avigdor Miller. And with that, we'll finish out Dr. Belkin. But before I go to Rabbi Lesson, I'll speak about my own run-ins, personal relations with Dr. Belkin. And it also just enforces the picture that we've painted of the man. The Rav's Hesped is the Rav. It's the Rav's unique style. The Rav already, this is 76, old age. But remember, he knew Dr. Belkin from 1932 on. So when the Rav talks about Dr. Belkin, Lashon Naki, the Chesed, and he doesn't mince words. He loved power. He exercised power. Vic Geller makes that point. He was the king. He was the president. The buck stops here. But his basic gestalt was one of simplicity, chesed, sone betza. These are such important qualities today. Halavai, we should have them or attempt to have them. Gentlemen, there are no classes next week. Sunday, Monday, the Kollel has vacation to enjoy the holiday of Hanukkah. The influence of Chabad is all around us. If you travel on the roads in Jerusalem, wherever you go, you see big menorahs. And yesterday we spoke at the end of class, the big fight in Teaneck, when many years ago Chabad wanted to put up the first big menorah, and the Jews wouldn't let them. A few freebies. Yomo, this is for you. You'll enjoy. These are comments by Rabbi Yonatan Berger. Gemaras, one of them I dealt with in class, but the rest are interesting. Gentlemen, here is the proof of the pudding. If you recall, I think it was in the Sunday class, I quoted from Masoret Moshe and how Rabbi Moshe Feinstein ripped the heck out of my Talmud, who had written a whole 500-page book, I think 600-page-plus book, proving you have to have a beard. And according to Rabbi Mordechai Tendler, and again, it's Ishmi Piyish, Mi Piyish, and Mordechai Tendler is a bit of a controversial figure, but I believe Rabbi Moshe, he's quoting him correctly, ripped the heck out of my student. How dare you say that Jews don't have a beard of sinners in all the Litvashi Yeshivat, they didn't have beards, etc. And Evan Abraham sent me a picture of Rabbi Raymond and other students. This is Tel's Yeshiva in before World War II. Do you see one beard among the students? Not one.
And it's all in the background, right? Picture from Kletsk.
You have Kletsk. I saw from Slabodka, Mir. But wow, what a picture! And you see the what do you call this? The chups they have. Wow, the amount of hair. Okay, if anyone is interested, these are two articles about the Einstein merger and with Montefiore collapsing. And one is from the Forwards, one is from the Jewish Week. They are sad pictures. Anyone who wants, you're welcome.
There's no multimillionaires in the Jewish world.
They're billionaires, you have to tap them. Here are pictures of the Hasidic Rebbe in Gilo, the Rushin Rebbe's direct descendant, named Rebbe Yisrael Rushin. He's the uncle of the present two Vishnitzer Rebbeim. He's the brother of the Vishnitzer Rebbe in Muncie, and he's the only Hasidic Rebbe alive who wears a shtreimel, and under the shtreimel is the kippah sruga. He's the only Hasidic Rebbe alive who has one son who is a brigadier general in the Israeli Defense Forces. The pictures are fascinating. Look at the crowd. And it's a sea of some of Hasidic people and Kippat Srugat around him. Here is something that I couldn't believe. The New York Times seriously recommends on Sunday, instead of wasting your time watching the football games, go to visit the Lubavitcher Rebbe's grave in Brooklyn near Queens, or Queens near Brooklyn. Here are two printouts of the article that's coming out in the latest Jewish Action on Neo-Hasidus, and mainly about YU, rekindling the flame Neo-Hasidus brings the inner light of Torah to modern Orthodoxy. For those of you that are Hasidim of the Mashpia, my Talmud, Rabbi David Weinberger, here's a picture, you can hang it up on your... David, I said, Moshe, excuse me, you know who I'm, Chas v'Chalil, who I confused him with. Here is a magazine that comes out, Lo Aleinu, what a cover. Midash Miat. This is for Gaboyim in the Shuls, their own magazine. Very fascinating. The cover is frightening. That's the tragedy in Hanof. Never, those are the bodies waiting to be collected. And it deals with the whole problem of security in Shuls and who is responsible for it. It's a very interesting article also how many of the old cities here have a central Beit Knesset who is responsible for the upkeep, because many of these Batei Knesiyot are now in areas where they barely have a minyan. There was an article in the weekend papers that the Tel Aviv main synagogue is being resuscitated, and a shul that was closed during the week now has 3 minyanim daily and has hundreds of people on Shabbat, and it's due to a young Gabbai who has resuscitated. Other shuls in North Tel Aviv are being resuscitated by Rabbanim, including a Talmud from this very Kollel. My dear students, I want to wish everyone a Chag Urim Sameach, and Be'ezrat Hashem, you should have a fabulous Chagiga tomorrow. I understand the spirit of Rav Shlomo Kabach will be brought to life in the auditorium here. If my energies are up to it, it's not an easy, we had a terrible tragedy in our building yesterday, so it's Zelo Pashut Bishvili. If my energies are up to it, my wife and I hope to attend. No class next week, but the week afterwards, we pick up exactly where we left off. If you have any interest in Teira and Erev and Halakha and Kapav and the Israeli military establishment, I wouldn't miss the next class in Sunday for all the latkes that will be consumed in Israel. And if the latkes don't add up, the sufganiyot certainly do. And in Monday, Rav Kefir and Rav Shmuel Belkin, Rav Yaakov Moshe HaKohen Lesson, and his son-in-law, Rav Avigdor Miller. Chag Urim Sameach, until we meet again in health and happiness, Tos V'danya. Thank you very much. Yitzchak, this is for you. Please take what you wish.
I added something.
What did you add?
That you did this.
Baruch Hashem.
It's very old. Good boy to...
Baruch Hashem.
So where are they sitting Shiva?
They're sitting Shiva in Emek Rephaim, in the house that she rented. They were not divorced. They were separated. Five Smats is the name of the street. He was a general in World War I, I understand. I don't know what his...
Smuts.
Well, here they spell it with an A. Smuts, okay. Okay, that's where they're sitting Shiva.
What, number five?
I think five, if not six.
There may be some stickers.
There's signs up. There's signs up on the shuls already. You follow?
Who's
committed suicide. In my house, there were three attempts, two succeeded. This guy tried twice. The second time, he did it.
In the building?
Jumped, yeah. Really? What are you talking? I pulled in from Gruss yesterday morning, 10:15. So I was lucky. Sam Dershowitz tried to pull in at 10:45. There were two police cars, an ambulance, the works, and they wouldn't let him pull in. Obviously, he was cordoned off, roped off. But the minute they found out that he had tried a year and two months ago, and they didn't send the body. Now, generally, you have to send the body to Abu Kabir for an autopsy, because he got in it, but they released the body right away. The chief rabbi spoke at the funeral, Rabbi David Lau. It turns out David Lau and Uli Friedman learned together in Nativ Meir. They were chavruta as kids. So the chief rabbi spoke. And how many children does he leave? Three or four?
Four
children.
What, they'll need good counsel.
Oh, God, it's so sad.
Mishukaki told me last week to listen to the part of Dabalichit. So I had time and I listened to it and got the Hashlamot Hayom.
Baruch Hashem, Baruch Hashem. Right. David Nair.
We'll but you know, there's one thing that was not. They tried to portray him as somebody who studied Biyawit, somebody who studied Achad Ha'am. He made you feel that you were second rate if you went into the real world.
I don't know if you're entirely right. You see, his son-in-law, professor of sociology, didn't.
I know. I don't know if he had a choice.
He looked very traditional.
No, I don't mean just before.
I found
when
him
I was
to be
a chaplain in the army, I came to see him,
right.
And I told the boys what I was doing. And he said to me, "Tell the boys one thing." I said, "Well, you know, tell them they shouldn't drive on Shabbos and not take a jeep to the chapel." I said, "I decided not to argue with him."
Right.
Because whatever, there were 150 boys.
Murray
would not have had anything.
I know what you're saying, Murray. Do you have a phone number for Vic Snow in America? Not here.
I may have it with me.
If you don't have it, email it to me here. I'll give you the email.
Yeah, I had from Kletsk, from my father-in-law, I could sell it to Bracha, and he's in the picture. He's in the picture, and he's
right.
Sitting here, and he's. The Rosh Hashiva has a beard.
Right.
And he always would say, he says, back then it wasn't that they didn't have a beard. He says, it was a chutzpah.
Right.
A chutzpah. Mamish
right.
A chutzpah
right.
For anyone to
right.
Put on a beard to think that they were...
Right. No, there's a picture of Baron Cutler. It's on the cover of the book of Making of a Gadol, where he's sitting clean shaven. That's probably a picture referring to, a Kletska picture.
Wow.
100%. But you're right. It was viewed as chutzpah. Absolutely.